Welcome to Mission in the Mitten, where we share the story of how God's mission is unfolding across the state of Michigan. These are stories of the church rightly being the church and serving in Jesus' name. Welcome to the season finale of Mission in the Mitten. Today's episode is going to be a little different. While I normally get guests from outside of the office, today I went inside the office and sat down with Reverend Dr. Scott Yakimo to discuss his experience in a variety of mission fields. We are so blessed that he brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the role of Director of Mission. We'll talk through his history, academic works, and his vision for sharing the gospel in Michigan. Enjoy this episode and stay tuned for a sneak preview of our new show premiering next week, right on this feed. So without further ado, listen to our interview with Reverend Dr. Scott Yakimo. All right. So can you go ahead and introduce yourself and share a bit about your background, both vocationally and from a theological standpoint?
Okay, well, yeah. My name is Scott Yakimo, new director of mission development for the Michigan District. A vocational background, it sort of depends on how far back you want to go. I've done a number of different things. I started my professional life as a mechanical engineer, but felt God calling me into ministry fairly quickly. It was actually my senior year in college, and that's when I took my first major overseas trip to Kenya and spent about 3 months there. While I was there doing helping some missionaries serve in Nairobi in the slums and also up in northern Kenya among a tribe called the Samburu. And then I spent a couple of weeks on the coast and met my very first Muslim with any serious engagement and fascinated me. And so I ended up getting a degree in Islamic studies while I was also a mechanical engineer. And then wanted to engage in overseas outreach, particularly to Muslims. So my wife, Miriam, and I were married a couple years into that and had our first child when we were at seminary, went to Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, was on the mission track. So 3 years at seminary, 2 years overseas, and went back to Kenya. And the two or three months in, my supervisor ended up having a medical issue and having to return to the States and never to come back. And so I ended up running a 5-country outreach in East Africa, going throughout Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Sudan. And wow. So it's really, really fascinating. Lots of travel, had another child while we were there and loved it. But it was really more like I hate to say it this way, but an old man's position, not a young man. And I was definitely young at the time. And so that's traveling about, 15 days a month or so. It was crazy. And with a young family. So we decided as a field that I'd return to the States, get a PhD, and then come back and teach at the seminary in Kenya. And so we did that. And I also spent a year in Morocco learning Arabic as well. You keep up my interest in Islam. Long story short, when the time came for me to return, and I did my PhD at the University of Virginia, studying with a Jewish philosopher named Peter Oakes. And when time came for me to return to Kenya, there are major changes happening in world mission, and it's about 2010 at the time. Mm-hmm. No one was being sent by the synod anywhere. And so I kept waiting. They kept saying, Scott, we'll send you. But I'm like, I've got to do something in the meantime. And then God opened up an amazing opportunity at Concordia University in Portland to be a theology prof there. And I figured, where's a better place in the United States to be a missionary than in Portland? And so headed up there, least churched area in the nation, and at a school which is majority of that time non-Christian. And I've got lots of stories from my time up there. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Really great outreach. A lot of people coming to Christ. Like one that I really appreciate was a former Wiccan priestess and eventually became an LCMS member. And then just recently finished her master's degree in theology and serving as a layperson. In any case, got lots of stories like that. Wonderful. And then we all know what happened to Portland. And so came to Ann Arbor. And different types of ministry, but wonderful ministry there as well, and really enjoyed it. Then again, we all know what happened to Ann Arbor. So I decided I'd stop shutting down universities, or that's what I like to joke. But when I saw this position come up to be able to essentially go back to what really was my first direct heart missions and particularly doing something that I did 20 years ago, you know, very similar in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I just jumped. I loved it, the opportunity, and I've been really enjoying it since then. And so in the meantime, I did mention my wife, Miriam. She's a deaconess, and she is called to St. Paul Lutheran in Hamburg. And I've got five kids, ages starting from 24 to 14. So that's a little bit of an intro.
Yeah, a busy life and a lot of changes. You've gone from engineering to missions, Arabic studies to shaping future pastors at Concordia's, and now here to the district office to lead missions. To you, what kind of unifies all of that journey for you? What drives each change?
Well, it's really his mission. Like you said, with the one that initially, well, the one that could initially be seen as not really making sense is the moving to being a professor. However, you know, the reason why I did that was because, you know, Portland, holy cow, right? I mean, amazing opportunities. And a lot of what I was learning, frankly, was pretty highfalutin academic stuff that didn't have a whole lot of application in Kenya. And so Portland was a really good stop. And then God called me over here to Ann Arbor after that. And he apparently wanted me here too, to train there, here focused more on training of future pastors and church workers, just because of there weren't as many at Portland. There was more peer outreach. Here was much more, you know, catechetical. But really, it's always been this desire to get the gospel out, to have people hear about Jesus, to be able to know who it is that makes a difference, that no matter what is going on in your life, he is there with you. And making sure people hear about that. That's sort of what's sort of been the driving thing here. That people just have an encounter with the living Christ, who is living and active, and is and needs your attention, and drawing people's attention to that. That's sort of been the unifying factor.
Yeah, I see that. So now that you're in this role as director of missions of the Michigan District, what made this call make sense for you?
Yeah, because, well, first of all, it's something like, it's very similar to what I did 20 years ago in East Africa. That's one thing that made a lot of sense to me, because it's a networking and accompanying role. That's really two of the major things, to accompany the work that God is already doing on the ground through other people, and finding ways to make sure that those ministries can increase and can spread and can occur throughout a fairly large geographical area. It's actually much more tightly confined than what I was in East Africa. If you look at the size of the African continent and on a scale map, it's massive. And I would, it's something like that. Yeah, everything like west of the Mississippi is about the area of that I covered in Africa. But it's very similar in a lot of ways. You have, church planting can occur in very similar ways with what we used to call mission training centers, where you have a location where lay people are trained to be able to go out and to bring together congregations, even as we respect the word and sacrament ministries going on. So, you know, sacrament was only done by ordained pastors, but still, you know, churches could be started in other ways. And then also just various human care ministries, too, just reaching out to people where they're at, what the needs are. And obviously in Africa, that is even more in your face than it is here in most places in Michigan, but not all. There are some places it's pretty much in your face, too. And also find ways to help with that. And one of the things that I've always wanted to do is keep the first thing first, meaning that if you make human care the first thing and that's your focus, that's going to take up all your time. If you keep the gospel first, then as you go, you will see the hungry, you will see the naked, you will see the sick. And as you go about this, you will engage in those ministries to help these people, but you won't lose the gospel. The gospel will still predominate, so that people might be able to, you know, hear the healer of their souls. Yeah. And And so it's really easy that if you focus only on human care to forget that gospel part. But if you focus on the gospel part, then you got to do the human care stuff, as you see. So you can't just say, tell someone to be warm and fed without actually making them warm and fed.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, I something that has kind of been on my mind as I think about you stepping into this role here is obviously God's timing and God's hand in it, because all of your experiences, your previous experiences, you know, shaping future pastors in the mission field overseas, and even your academic work kind of really, really feeds in to the moment we are in here in the district. And so what excites you about the mission field right here in Michigan?
So many different things. First of all, since I've gotten here and I talked to President Davis about this, it's like I just want to be in full on learning mode, which, by the way, is a missionary principle. OK, I mean, this is part of what it means to be a good missionary, is not to show up and think that you've got all the answers.
You've got the answers.
But rather to figure out what's going on and hearing the needs and seeing the amazing things that are happening. And I've just been, you know, and just praising God over and over again by seeing so many great things that are currently going on in the district. You know, I'm thinking anything from the ethnic ministries of that being able to visit to this point. I was up at St. Luke's in Lansing, their Christ campus, visiting their Swahili service. I intend to get to their Arabic service fairly soon. And just watching what an amazing joy that is to see. And seeing how the Congolese there are already organized, have organized themselves, and across, in fact, the entire Midwest and beyond, to ministries like Camp Restores, you know, from RSOs, and what they're doing in such a blighted area of Detroit, or A2E with Pastor Bodley out there. At Bethany in Detroit, or the Franklin Avenue Mission, or Beyond the Breakwater, all these different locations, and just seeing these different things. And so I think what really excites me about this, and also the campus stuff too, mm-hmm. with the expanding now that we've lost our university, that we are going to, you know, take all the universities. I think that we should, especially the public ones, and starting different ministries and other opportunities there. So right now, I don't know if there's really just one thing that really excites me about. There's many things that I find exciting. The more and more as we go forward here, the more and more things that will develop and that we'll, you know, maybe focus more on as things go. And also vocational school, another exciting opportunity to start. So yeah, I think that probably if there one thing is, it would probably be the various ministries that are out there and the way that those can be expanded regardless of ethnicity. And I think that is sort of a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, there's so much going on in our district that I feel like just even the ones you mentioned scratch the surface of what is going on within Michigan. But if we can shift just a little bit to talking kind of about, you know, the cultural moment we are in Michigan. You've done some previous academic work about the challenges of reaching the nuns and the duns. What does faithful gospel engagement look like for these groups in our district? To kind of expand on that question, what is unique about Michiganders in these categories?
What is unique about Michiganders? We've got good football teams. We're also a very prideful bunch. We're also a fairly sarcastic lot, I've noticed. And as a native Michigander, obviously I grew up with that. However, I went other places in the nation and realized that sarcasm is not the love language. And so it made some interesting events when non-sarcastic cultures. I don't know if there's, I mean, Michigan is unique in some ways, but I think there's a lot of overlap with different areas. The nuns and the duns was something that I thought a lot about, particularly when I was in Portland. And that's because we had so many nuns and duns, and that's starting to rise here in Michigan too. But it's still not to the same degree, at least from what I've seen, as it was in the Pacific Northwest. But really, what that is about, and reaching out to people in those categories, is really about changing or casting a vision that people can actually perceive as being more beautiful than the vision by which they currently live. Everybody's got some type of an idea of what is the beautiful, what is the most valuable thing in life. And then they, whatever that vision is what orients that person's life. And everyone's got something like that. Then the question then becomes is, well, how satisfactory is that? Does that actually help you? Does it actually, is this the best way to live? And for a lot of people, I mean, you know, when you've got that vision, it enables you to see things, certain things, and not see others. And, you know, Jesus talked about this in terms of eyes, you know, ears to hear and eyes to see. And, you just perceive the world in a certain way. So then the question then becomes is how do you change those perceptions and how do you get actually cast a vision of what is truly most beautiful, what is truly most glorious? And that's, of course, a life with Christ and understand who Christ is and what he has done for us, what he continues to do for us. And being able to find ways to get a narrative out there to be able to plant this different way of seeing the world so that the eyes can start to be developed and to be able to see, the ears can start to hear and start to perceive things differently. And I think that, and like I say, I had a lot of encounters with this, particularly in my ministry in Portland. But also I think it's very applicable here as well, because I think it looks different, I think, everywhere. But I mean, I think it also looks different just based on the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. While our cultures are the Michiganian culture is definitely different than the Pacific Northwest or Virginia or Missouri or Alabama. But I think the basic principles do translate fairly well, because it really is a matter of also, you know, translating so that people can actually understand what the gospel is.
Yeah. It's interesting with those cultural translations of the gospel. Different times and different moments present the opportunity to explain the gospel in different ways. So what does it mean to read the sign of the times? And how do you see that shaping how the church engages her neighbors today?
Yeah, the signs of the times. I think that right now, what we, especially post-COVID, a lot of people now in the church are, who actually remain in the church, are people who are actually more committed, I think, in a lot of ways. Because I think there are a lot of people who are more culturally involved. And now I think that culture is pretty much gone. People talk about the post-Constantinianism. I think that's appropriate. There's some overlap, I think, with pre-Constantinian world before the time when Christianity really had cultural sway and political sway. Well, it hasn't had political sway for quite a while, maybe since the 80s, where you still had the moral majority, some type of generalized sense of morality. But now that's, I think, almost not just political sway, but I think the cultural sway is essentially gone for Christians. For Christianity in general. In fact, a lot of times people now look down upon Christians and just, you know, very broadly across the culture. And I think that's actually, I mean, it's of course a challenging aspect, but I think it's actually, rather than looking at it as a challenge, I think, well, it is a challenge, but I think it's actually a fantastic opportunity, because now we can actually get back to what are those things that are most crucial for Christianity and for having this particular culture in this day encounter the gospel. A lot of that is simply being Christian. What I mean by that is looking back at these ministries we've got going on, is actually engaging the world in helpful ways and not manipulative ways, not to somehow, you know, increase the number of rumps in the seats of our pews, but to rather, I mean, hopefully we hope and pray that that will happen, but that's not the point. The point is to minister and to show God's love in every situation by deed and by word. It can't just be by deed alone, because you got lots of people doing lots of types of things. You have to say, this is why I'm doing it, but still doing it. And so I think that part of the signs of the times is to realize that Christianity can make a big difference in culture. But we need to live in ways that actually make that difference. And we've got an opportunity where to now speak into more of a vacuum or even a maybe possibly hostile world. And be able to, and that's actually a really great opportunity because now it says, who are you? Who are we? What are we really? And then the answer is, well, here's who we really are.
Yeah. It's interesting. Something that I think about in how our culture kind of interacts with Christianity in these days, that I've said before to people is, for me growing up, I didn't belong to a church. I was part of that nun category. And, with my parents being duns, so then we were like the first generation nuns. but even in my hometown, which is a very small, politically conservative, socially tight-knit community, that if you let your Christianity impact any of the decisions you made, you were framed as a zealot or weird. It was, yeah, you could be Christian. You were, and if a lot of people were, but, and they attended church, but if it impacted any of the decisions you made, automatically zealot. And I feel like we see that a lot today, where it's, if it has any influence on the decisions you make or on how you believe or think, that it is, you're framed as overly zealous when it's just maybe how Christian life looks. I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit, but that's something that I think about.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's something I think you actually should lean into. You know, I've got kids who are, you know, in high school still, and I find it really interesting that they choose to wear a lot of Jesus stuff. You know, like. different things about that, and also crosses and this kind of thing. But I also think about just one time I was with my family. We're having lunch at this is back to Portland again. We're having just lunch in a restaurant, and we prayed, you know, like we always do before lunch or before we pray out loud, and just the common table prayer. Well, the waitress came over and says, and she's like, "Are you guys Christians?" I'm like, "Well, yeah." And she's like, "Oh, I've never seen somebody pray before except for the Muslims. The Muslims are the only ones who pray." And she's like, "It was really sort of cool to see you pray." And that encounter just really, you know, stuck with me because there was a nun, right? You know, like you mentioned being a nun, and she'd said, "Never seen that before." And so, yeah, you might be regarded as a zealot, but also just be human and make sure. And make sure your humanity and your normalness also shines through too. And then people start to wonder, how can you be both? Mm-hmm. How can you both actually care a lot about this, but still live, you know, a normal life, in a decent life? And that's, I think, part of what it means to cast a vision or to embody a different way of beauty, of being in the world, where you can talk about your faith. You can make decisions based upon your faith. Well, there was a situation that recently happened where one of my kids had to make a hard decision regarding a friend and their behavior, and it was based upon my child's faith. I don't want to be too specific here, but my child did it and handled the whole situation very, very well. And got a lot of respect from her non-Christian friends for it, and also from the broader community for the way my child handled it. So, in any case, I think that it's actually a good thing to lean into and always treat people with love, with care, and that's also dominant: kindness, love, you know, and true love, not wishy-washy stuff. And that's how to respond to that.
Yeah, I keep going back to this concept that I've been reading about how, because we've kind of lost that cultural foothold as Christians, if it ever really was there to begin with, you know, since we've lost that cultural footprint, when people, especially like Gen Z or younger, or even the millennial generation, seek out church experiences, they are seeking out something different. They already know that they're going to expect to experience something different, because they are seeking that out. And so that doesn't mean that we always lean into that difference from the culture. But it's just something to note, is that when we're encountering people who are first-time attenders, who are in the nuns and the duns, that they're expecting to experience something different from Christians. And so we need to give them something different than the world would.
Yeah. There's a lot on this. There's a very short article by Robert Louis Wilkin, who talks about the church's way of speaking, and deals with just these types of issues. Yeah. And that's okay for the church to be a weirder place. And because it is a matter of being inculcated. Oh boy, this actually reminds me of something that's pretty hilarious in some ways, by Augustine. But in other ways, and I bring it up because Asher makes a good point. He has this really odd, and I'm just going to say it's flat out odd, interpretation of Psalm, I'm forgetting which one, but it's about, we've got these white horses on a hill, and he interprets the horses as teeth and the hill as gums. And then he takes the application and says that the teeth and the gums are like the church. And they masticate, eat the new believers, so they become part of the body. I thought that, really weird imagery. I don't know if we got the psalm right, but the outcome is a good one. Yes. Idea that it is being absorbed into a new body, a new way of being, and so if that means that we use weird language in church, well, like you said, people are already expecting it. I think about a different student who once started yelling at me. It wasn't my fault, but she was upset because the church, I mean, for her, this was, again, not me, whether my views are whatever, but her views were that she's like, you guys have all this stuff in your 2000 year old tradition, and you guys are just getting rid of it. Why? and for her, who was among the nuns, And she was very offended by that. So I thought that was really interesting. So she was expecting something weird in the church, and she was expecting that that we would be who we are and use that weird language or whatever. And took me to task. It wasn't even my fault for somehow abandoning things like this. But she's just so worked up about the whole idea. So, yeah. So, I agree. I think that the church needs to maintain the church's language and form believers to be believers, and with the language that we have.
Yeah. And on the other side of that, too, we seek new ways to engage with our neighbor. We seek to speak each other's language and understand the culture in which we all come from.
Christ always incarnates. He always comes down. You always have to find those bridges between Christianity and between what the world is. You must understand the culture. Absolutely. And really, I think the best metaphor here is one of translation, and which means you have to fully be able to understand what the signs of that culture are and be able to grab hold of those, and to be able to meet people where they're at. But then also too, I mean, eventually, hopefully they'll be taken to a different location too, and see what that does within cultures. But Christ always incarnates, the word always incarnates.
So we just spoke about some of your academic work that you've done, but I'd like to specifically hone in about an article you did in the winter 2020 edition of the Concordia Theological Journal. Your editorial on doctrinal narcissism, you warn against theology that forgets its purpose. Yes. What would you say that purpose is, and how does that impact mission?
The purpose is always reparative. And what I mean by that is the purpose is always to be able to find the way to proclaim the word so that sick people become healthy, so that those who hear to whom you're speaking realize both their sinfulness but also see their Savior. And that is the whole point of Lutheran theology, ultimately, is to be able to get to that reparative purpose, to be able to get the person who is thoroughly broken, who is thoroughly hopeless in their own selves, to be able to encounter the one who is hope, the one who can save them, the one who does save them, the one who has pursued them, and be able to get to that particular encounter. And what doctrine does, it plays a very crucial role. And also in that article, right, well, brief editorial, I was very careful to say this, that doctrine is crucial. Doctrine plays a very, very important role. But you have to understand what that role is. And that is to make sure to set the boundaries of what can be proclaimed. It's like what doctrine does is it gets the rules of the game. You want to make sure you're playing the Christian game. You know, so like you make metaphor like with basketball. You can say that, you know, if you're playing basketball, well, you've got a court that's this size generally. You know, you may get a little wiggle room on that one, but generally a 10-foot hoop basketball. Unless you're an NBA player, and especially if you're LeBron, but except for him, everyone else should at least dribble the ball occasionally. And you can't just knock people over, you know, because they're playing football or whatever. But that's what doctrine does. It sets the boundaries. And if you cross these boundaries, then you're not playing the Christian game, if you will. Okay, yeah, just a metaphor. You're not speaking like a Christian. You're not acting like a Christian. You need to stay within the doctrinal boundaries. And so it's very important to learn those. But the point of the boundaries is not the boundaries. The point is to watch, you know, is to watch Jordan, the best basketball player of all time, you know, be a poet, you know, as he's doing, in that case, the life of basketball. But the goal then is to be able to be the person who lives the life of Christ, and what that is, you just look, what did Christ do? And, you know, he healed the sick. He helped people. He fed, you know, the 5,000. He did so many things, and always pointing to his Father and to his own mission. And so that's sort of the goal that we have, is to be able to bring people to the point, humanly possible. Of course, everything is up to the working of the Spirit, but to do the best we can to get out of the way, to duck, to be able to see that, you know, like, you know, when they're not looking at us, they're looking at the cross, to be, you know, the John the Baptist who's always pointing to the cross and pointing to Christ. Yeah. And so people can actually see who that is, who their Savior is. And if they're going to stumble, Lord, please let it not be over me. You know, let it be over the gospel. And if somebody stumbles over the gospel, well, that's up to them and God. I mean, Well, at least they stumbled over you. And so that's the point I was trying to make there. And I think that there's a tendency in our synod to think about doctrine for doctrine's sake. And now even I think the people who express this tendency, I think in their actual pastoral practice, I think they're actually probably really good, very loving, very kind, doing a great job dividing law and gospel and applying to their parishioners or to their friends, whatever. But I think there's a felicitous inconsistency, if I can, you know, take one of our Lutheran theologians, Pieper's, words on this, where unfelicitously they're focusing too much on doctrine for doctrine's sake, but felicitously they in their actual practice they always look for that moment of repair and point people to Christ. So that was the point of that editorial, was really to not denigrate doctrine. Doctrine is crucial. We can't play the Christian game without it. And that's also, I'm a teacher of theology. It matters. I care about it. But to put it in its proper place and its proper ordering within the larger picture of God's word, what God is doing by his word.
Mm-hmm. I think we as LCMS Lutherans have a tendency to enjoy thinking about theology and enjoy honestly arguing about it, or at least presenting our viewpoints on it in a way that doesn't always lead to the best fruit. but because something that I have thought about, especially when it comes to Lutheran content, since I am a content, I don't like saying I'm a content creator, but I've written stuff for the Synod, and I have gone through doctrine review. I think sometimes we have a hard time with how our theology is lived out in the messiness of real lives. That we can think about it all that we want, that we can think about our theology and what it means for our lives. But when we're actually presented with the mess of real life, the mess of sin, that it makes us uncomfortable to live out those theological systems, and especially as content to write or speak about that. So what advice would you have for pastors or other church workers who may be tempted to stay in that comfort zone of talking about theological systems rather than engaging with the messiness of real life?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I think the best answer is to go. Tell them to go. The first words of the Great Commission, I agree with you that a lot of times the way we discuss doctrine and the sin can be very harmful. And I certainly agree with that. I do love the fact that we still love doctrine, though. And I think that is a really crucial thing and very unique in a lot of ways in for, you know, especially in so-called Protestant Christianity, which I don't consider ourselves Protestant. But anyway, most people do. And so I think that's actually a good thing that we actually care about doctrine. But I think that you're also right that sometimes this inhibits the actual what the point of it is, again, it's to protect the proclamation as we go. It's to make sure that we're doing the best we can and saying what God would have us say and do in any given situation. But with the reality that even our best acts are tinged with sin. You know, Luther's theology of the cross is here. Absolutely. And that we might, there's gonna be lots of times we've tried to be as faithful as we can, do what we can, and maybe we get it wrong, or maybe the whole situation is just so strange, and this is the messiness you talk about, is that you just got to get messy, and it's just in the mess. And you sort of, it's easy to back off. It's easy to throw stones. It's hard to actually do, I think, the real messy ministry.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, but that's really where you have to be. A lot of my theoretical work I've done is precisely using pragmatism for this, not of the, for those of you who are philosophers, not of the Jamesian variety where it's like, you know, truth is whatever works, but more of the Charles Peircean variety, which is the, where there is an actual thing that's true. There's something that's real. But at the same time, you got to focus on what the practical outcomes are of all your theory. And, you know, if people ever read anything about Peirce, you'll know that he is an amazingly difficult read because he's so complicated. I think he's largely right on many things, at least in his philosophical system. And I think it also does help here because he's saying that, look, what does this practically mean? And until you know what something means practically, you don't know what it means. So you might say that Jesus is Lord. Well, what does that mean? And until you get to practice, how is he Lord in this situation over this person's addiction? How is he Lord in this person who's struggling with or who has been impacted by gun violence, you know, and or whatever, or food insecurity? Okay, until you figure out what does that lordship look like in that situation, maybe that concept of Jesus Lord that you have needs to be expanded, and needs to get some definition to what that actually means. And I think that's a lifelong process. You know, one of the things I think is most important is to be educable. And realize that you're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. That's how learning occurs. But you can't learn anything until you can state it, and until you can you can express it somehow. And sometimes that when it comes to theology by its nature, it must be expressed. It must be expressed both verbally, but also in your actions towards others and the way you handle things, and showing true love, which is not just simple affirmation, but it's actually care for the entirety of the person and that person's ultimate health in light of the reality of who they are in Christ. And so I would say, I mean, go get hit. You're gonna get dirty, and people are gonna criticize you. That's okay. How did Jesus do with that criticism thing? You know, how did Paul do with that criticism thing? You know, how about the rest of the apostles? Yeah, they were criticized pretty fiercely for what they did. This goes for men and women, but have broad shoulders and keep going.
Yeah. There's a quote that I kind of love that I've been seeing around where it says, you can't throw stones while washing feet. I love that it's those two stories of Jesus essentially being the most perfect example of what we can be, of what we should be. And even though we fail, you know, he's there for us. So as we think about this post-Christian age, In some of your other academic work, you propose a semiotic approach to how we communicate the gospel. What does that look like or mean practically, since we're speaking about practice?
Yeah, it actually means a lot of what I've been saying, because that sort of informs everything that I'm talking about, which is the need to actually engage the world. You know, semiotics it just means study of signs, for those who may not know that. And that's how all of our information comes. I mean, it comes, you know, in the beginning was the Word, right? And the Word was God. You know, throughout the Gospel of John, you even use the word signs all over the place, Emmaus. And but that's how our knowledge of everything comes about. And I'd also say that's how the world came about, was through signs, the spoken through God speaking the world into existence. And so really in that way, you know, they're part and parcel of how we live. And so in a semiotic approach, it needs to recognize these things. And one of the things I outlined is something I call proclamatory pragmatism. And I called that as a way to describe how Lutherans reason. And again, what does that mean practically? Well, it means that we focus on I think it's not just Lutheran thought. I'd argue this is simply Christian thought, that we focus on this person in front of us, or this congregation in front of us too, but these people in front of us. What would God want me to say to them so that they might cling to him more strongly? And, you know, also talks this way. He's got the double rule of charity, right? If it increases the love of God, love of man, then these are good things. And so how do you actually hit that moment? I've called it the reparative moment, that moment of encounter, whether it's the moment of conversion, or whether it's a moment of reconversion, which is like a daily thing, as we remember, you know, as you think about our own sins, you know, that moment of absolution. But to always drive to that, and developing that really is a skill. That's also why I use the language of basketball. You know, we're not all Michael Jordans. Well, I'll leave LeBron out of it. And, you know, as we're doing these things, but that's sort of who we strive to be. You know, we strive to improve. We strive to, have a closer walk with Christ, to be able to mirror his life better in our own, by the work of the Spirit in our lives as well, but also as we struggle with that too, in the realm of sanctification. And so it really does come down to those things. It comes to going, it comes to understanding that life is messy, but there needs to be a Christian presence there. The Christian presence is formed by a certain way that you think about things, and that's perception of beauty. It's an aesthetic thing, where you aesthetic. There we go. Thing about what is most beautiful, and how do you think about that? It also makes sure that you don't go off the boundaries and do something else. You might want to be nice to everybody, but that's not necessarily Christianity. It's not nice in Christianity. Always go together. Love always does, but sometimes love does not look too nice. it can be very sort of in your face too sometimes, just out of care for the person. But make sure you don't go outside those bounds. And but then always, again, keeping the purpose in mind. Heck, Charles Peirce called this firstness, secondness, and thirdness in his philosophical categories. But, you know, over the years I've realized those categories I can keep up here, and we talk about them better in other ways. Yes. So,
yes. I think it's really interesting to talk about that with the idea of like the spiritually disillusioned. Or skeptical, but mostly spiritually disillusioned, because of the ways they've already experienced Christian thought, or Christian love, even as we talk about how love is sometimes in your face and sometimes does not look like you expect it to. But let's move into kind of our vision stage. As you begin this role here at the district, what kind of partnerships or initiatives do you hope to foster here?
I'll just go back. I don't want to harp too much on the hardness, and Because recently, yeah. Remember, we had those Westboro Baptists who decided to show up at our youth gathering, and you ask any one of them what they believe they're doing. They believe they're speaking the truth in love. Okay, no. It is gentle. Okay.
Yes.
And kind, but you know, I guess nice is just a little bit too floopy. It's deeper than this. Joy is not equal to happiness. Even though you can be happy, but you can be joyful in unhappy situations too. So it's just deeper concepts. And what was the question again? It was vision for the.
What kind of partnerships or initiatives do you hope to foster here in the district?
Oh yeah, good. Hopefully a number of them. One of the things that, and this is why I'm going out meeting people, because I believe, you know, ministry is all about people. And I'm trying to figure out what, as I meet people, one of the big goals, especially the first time I sit down with them, is just to figure out who they are and figure out, you know, what are their passions? What are they, you know, really just enjoying about their ministries? And what does that look like? Also, maybe with some of the struggles they have, getting them a little more personally in their, you know, families, this kind of thing. Trying to figure out, you know, who is there, what are they doing, and how has God been using them? And then it's really trying to read, you know, go back to signs, you know, the signs of what God has been doing already here, and following that, like you'd follow, you know, a trail of crumbs to see where it goes, and what God has already been active in doing. And so therefore, trying to find ways to increase the capacity, particularly of ministries that seem to be very healthy. There are some churches out there that don't want to work with the district at all, and that's fine. Nothing says you have to. You know, you also can't push your rope, and that's fine. And they're also doing wonderful things. But for those who do want to be involved and do want to and are doing things that seem to be going very well and very healthy with strong missiologies, to increase those, to find those people, and to find, hey, what can we do to help you out? And not necessarily to be the person who comes in knowing everything, because I don't think that's a possibility. And certainly to know everything. And but rather to be the person who can learn to figure out, again, what is happening in this location, in this particular locale, and with this particular subculture, because there's so many different cultures in Michigan as well, within this subculture, and then saying, hey, well, what can we do? You know, what do you need? How can we help? And finding ways we can help, and, you know, other ways maybe we can, but just see where that is. So I'm really looking forward to partnering with people who are really interested in going and getting out and doing something. Also encouraging, you know, those who may not quite be on the going place yet, but to maybe you think about it and to get going. I sometimes a lot of these conversations can get scolding, and I don't think that's a helpful stance either. But simply, again, you know, pursuing a vision of what the Christian life can look like and how it can actually really change people's lives over and over again, and showing evidence of that change to the best possible way, so that more and more people might want to get involved.
Yeah. That kind of reminds me of like next year's district theme, which is live to tell about it, and how recently in a meeting we were talking about how there's kind of two different parts of that, how there is the live in such a way and then the to tell about it, and how different congregations might be differently positioned to do either one of those in different ways. But if you had unlimited resources, where would you begin?
Boy, if I had unlimited resources, mm-hmm. I'd probably begin again with some of the current ministries, and that are going well, and trying to find ways to encourage other congregations to mirror those types of practices. And so that's probably where I would begin, is with things that are currently going well, where the word is going forth, where people are being served and helped. And then taking those resources and taking what we learned there, lessons learned, and trying to encourage other people, largely by seeing, you know, like, I think mm-hmm. that a big part of this is that to really catch a vision, you've got to see it in action, and you actually yes. have to go there and see. It's not enough to hearing about is good, but and seeing a video about is fine, but actually being in the location. So maybe taking people also to visit those locations and to see how they might work in their community, because, you know, something that works maybe in, you know, that looks one way in, you know, in northern Detroit, or one way in Midland, or one way in Lansing is going to look very different than maybe somewhere in suburban, you know, Rochester Hills, or, you know, or elsewhere, or small town Brighton, where I live. It's going to look very different. But there can be some general principles, and those principles, I think, can be appropriated. And so it would be really trying to encourage people, using unlimited resources just to get people to go, to go on to do things and to see. And because once you go, you know, one of the cool things is that the spirit's there, and the spirit will guide you, will give you the words to say, and you don't have to puzzle about it a whole lot. Just be who God is calling you to be. And as you go, you will be doing what, you know, as long as you keep your eyes on Christ, you will be doing the Christ ministry there. So I guess to answer your question, unlimited resources, trying to get people to go.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of the times our congregations, when you ask them about, what are you doing for mission? They have answers. But what encouragement would you give to our congregations who may feel like they're overwhelmed, tired, or unsure about where to begin in going? What kind of encouragement or suggestions would you give to them?
Yeah, I think the very first thing is talking about that, again, this is not our ministry, this is Christ's ministry. And what that means is that means that you have to be able to encounter the other. If we get into a mentality, I'm afraid it might sound a little scolding, which is not something I want to do. But if we get a mentality where we're focusing just on like our survival, that's a spiral. It's not a good place to be. And if you love what's happening now, you can make it better. And one of the things that to me very recently has become more and more valuable is actually an image that that Rembrandt has painted. It's called Christ in the Storm. And if you go to my office, I've got big old, you know, canvas picture of it. And somebody recently came in and said, "Why do you have such a dark picture on your wall?" I'm like, "I don't see it as dark at all. I mean, I guess physically it's a little dark, but I mean, but not in theme." The way Rembrandt did it is he's picturing the 12 disciples in the boat, and they're in this massive storm, water's coming over the gunwales. It looks like the boat's about to flip over. But you look at the back of the boat, and here's the thing that really touches me is you see Jesus, but he's awake. Okay? He's awake. Even in the midst of that storm, guess what? He's awake. And he is the Lord of the sea and the sky. Okay. And so for congregations that are looking, that are, like you say, downtrodden, seeing all the problems that are going on, seeing that, are we going to still be here next year, or will be another church that closes? And there are a number of churches that have closed. But to look that in the midst of this storm, Jesus is awake. Mm-hmm. This storm too is inside his control. So look to him, and he can get us through all these things. And life and the congregational life can get so much better. And the way to do that, frankly, is by going.
That's good stuff. that's great stuff. Yeah, I feel like we can often focus on what we aren't doing, or what we see other congregations doing or failing at. We can look at both, either their successes or their failures, and look around us and be like totally discouraged by our own lack of movement or movement that we are doing. It might not seem like enough, but Jesus is in it. He's in it all. And he knows what's happening.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, that I do think that we have a lot, particularly in the Michigan district, being, you know, one of the largest, wealthiest districts, you know, if you look at it in terms of money, whatever, and districts in the Missouri Synod, is there's a spirit of competition between pastors, between churches. And I think that that's a really, and here is, I think actually this is a legit scold, is I think that we really need to stop doing that. And this is a lesson that, I'm going to take back just from my time in the Northwest District, where, you know, culturally, you know, Christianity has not had a hold there for a long time. And in Oregon, Washington, believe me, Lutherans are not the thing. And so everybody was sort of, you know, it's like, we're in this fight all together. Let's try to figure out how to do that. And that's really the situation we are in, because we've got we do have some very large congregations that, you know, at least in the outside look to be doing, you know, by our, the different human measurements that we use well, and this kind of thing. And so then we start to get jealous of them or want to protect what we have. And no, I think what we need to again realize that no, we're all, and go back to the boat metaphor, we're all in that boat, mm-hmm. and the winds are coming against us. And we're all in the boat together, and trying to find a way to make sure that we are all pulling together, and that we all trust each other, and find ways, maybe dialogues, we're seeing together. I know that these Pastor Richter is doing harvest tables, which is a big thing to try to develop trust and between different churches, and so you reach out together as a church plant, or maybe even, you know, uniting some churches into different types of structures where you can reduce the amount of administrative overhead, mm-hmm. And in multiple campuses, but this is all going to take, you know, trust and realizing the situation that we are in, which is that we do need to all pull together on this, and that Christ is calling us to do His mission, not my mission, not your mission, His mission. And we all have our roles, but ultimately it's Him. And just trying to figure out what that is.
Yeah, back in February at our We Are Not Alone theological conference, Pastor Jeff Clater from Christ Memorial in St. Louis, he spoke about maybe having the mentality that we are a multi-site church, that our district and the synod in general is just a multi-site church. So we share resources, we collaborate together, and we treat it that way. Of course, there are both legal and cultural reasons that we do not behave that way currently, but just thinking in that sort of mentality, who can I borrow from? Who can I share with? That way of thinking is what's going to move us into this next decade, century, moving forward.
I agree with that, because we need to be able to find ways, you know, especially when you have if you're just looking at financial struggles for congregations. There are some congregations that are struggling very much financially, others that are not. And trying to find ways that we can support each other, and you know that, you know, multi-site ministries. One of the things that is in the LCMS blood is the whole congregational, you know, system that we have, yes. Voltairean system, which is good. I'm not nothing against it, but sometimes it can tend to this lone wolf approach. Mm-hmm. That's sort of this you know, competitive thing. Even though we're all sinners, we'd find new ways to sin.
Yeah.
But it can lead to those particular sins. But I think that we really do need to, again, post-Constantinian world, also post-COVID world, the idea of multi-site, I think has a lot going for it. You know how that legalities work out, whatever, but just as a model, where you can also have then, you know, like maybe, you know, got sort of like the larger congregation, maybe four smaller ones, and then you can also get, it becomes also like a mini feeder as well for, like, you know, senior pastors and this kind of thing and whatever. And also it gives a built-in support. I mean, if you got, mm-hmm. let's say you got, you know, five locations and you know, three or four pastors serving the different ones, you know, they can also come together and talk, you know, as shepherds, and also with other staff, of course, but I'm just thinking pastoral staff. I think there's a lot to be said for it.
Yeah. Something my circuit is talking about right now, that just as an example of this, is the potential of us coming together as the four or five churches in the area and hiring one IT person, just one IT person for these four or five different sites. And we aren't sure how that would look yet. Maybe it's a different rotation of weeks they're at one place, but in order to just, I don't want to say get our act together, but kind of get our act together on the IT side of things, we might not, one church alone might not necessarily be able to handle or even have the workload for one person, but churches together can might be able to have a full-time staff person who moves around. That's just something that we're thinking about.
Yeah, yeah, and that's part of these things that you can do for administration. You know, use the business term synergies, and you know, try to find ways that. And that's a perfect example of one, because now you're going to get, rather than a volunteer who may or may not be any good, you know, with it, you know, hey, my grandson, you know, the, you know, that kind of thing. But someone who's actually a professional and can actually do these things and do it well. And same thing with, you know, with business operations, treasurer, you know, this kind of thing. And there could be a lot of overlap, and that we don't necessarily need each congregation doesn't necessarily need to do it for themselves.
Yes.
And also, by the way, I think this also goes to the RSOs that are in the district, their headquartered in the district. I think that one of the things that I've been noticing is just when they're, you know, you got these guys out there, and they're so busy doing ministry, and that's why they got into it. But they don't have the expertise for fundraising. You know, maybe there'd be a way that we could get together and they could, you know, organize some type of a professional fundraiser or something like this. You know, development person to be able to help them with their financial issues, because they might not. I mean, that's not the skill set that got them into it. They had a different set of skills. And they need somebody with that specialized skill set that is so important to a church and a ministry, of getting out what God is doing through them, so that people of God might participate in it, you know, time, treasure, talent, that whole thing. I'm fully on board with those kind of things. I think we need to be thinking that way, and not just each in our own congregation or each in our own silo.
Yeah, I think that is the way forward, to be able to pursue mission full-heartedly without worrying about protecting our resources, if that makes sense. But I think we've kind of gone through the questions that I had written down. So is there anything we missed that you'd like to discuss or add?
At this point, I think what I'd like to add is just that I want to go back to that Rembrandt painting. Right now, the church is just really... We want to say that that's in a really uniquely difficult time. I mean, you read the book of Revelation. It just describes, you know, Revelation really is about the ongoing state of the church. And it just describes, we've always been here, okay? There's never been a time in the life of the church or life of the Christian where there isn't a storm. Something's going on. And the storm we're in might look different, perhaps, than other storms before it, but there's going to be a lot of similarities. But I think in the midst of the storm, we just and there are some very stormy places right now. We realize that Christ is awake in the boat, and he is watching these things. He knows it, and he's using these things for reasons we don't always understand. We may never understand. We might also eventually understand too. But we know who he is. It's like C.S. Lewis. You know, back in the old Chronicles of Narnia stuff. You know, I forget, Lucy. Asked, well, I think it was a beaver. About Aslan, and she asked him. You know, is he a safe lion? And the response was, no, he's not a safe lion, but he's good. And that's the thing, that the Christian life is not a safe life. It's just not. But God is with us. Christ is with us. He's been through worse too. And he's good. Yes. And so, yeah, just trust that, as we go through these different things.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Listeners, as always, you can find the links to all that was discussed in the show notes. My hope is that this interview helps you and your congregation get to know the heart of the district office, especially as we walk together in reaching people with the good news. That is the mission of the Mitten. Additionally, thank you, listeners, for listening to this season of Mission in the Mitten. Scott, I don't know if you knew this, but you are the finale episode for this season. We'll be back again soon with more about missions, projects, and evangelism in the near future. But next week, we're going to start a new bi-weekly program, Conversations on Culture and Faith. Stick around after this episode, and you'll hear the trailer for season 1. thank you again, Scott, for participating in this interview.
Thank you. God bless.
This podcast is a production of the Michigan District of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. To learn more about our ministry and to stay connected, visit our website at michigandistrict.org or follow us on social media at MIDistrictLCMS. Thank you for listening. Welcome to Conversations on Culture and Faith, where we dive into big questions shaping our world through our uniquely Lutheran lens.
I wanted to be 100% myself. If I'm going to lose, like, at least be honest.
You know, at what point do we, you know, flirt with the abolishment of the Mass?
Maybe I could be a pastor. Maybe this was a thing that I could do. It was a very boring way of arriving at that.
This is a space to ask the hard questions about worship, vocation, identity, and how our faith meets the world head on.
Like, if I could go back and tell myself one thing, like, you do not need to be so stressed in middle school about college.
People will only participate as much as they have permission to, based off the participation of those leading.
There may not be any greater influence than just being in the church all the time.
I think I would have gone a little crazy if I didn't have God during Girls' Save, because it's such a high-pressure, intense week that if you don't have something grounding you, like, you will go crazy.
We unpack culture, we challenge perspectives, and like Paul reminds us in Romans 12, verse 2, we seek transformation through the renewing of our minds.
There are so many different ways you can serve a church. We could maybe see where our gifts would fit.
And I think just making people feel seen is something that we don't have in actual government today.
The sexual part of the conversation naturally fits into these other aspects of Christian life. Like, if you're not talking about all of it, you're going to get stuck.
Our message doesn't change. God's grace for us, amazing grace through Jesus, it's the same. But it means, okay, what messengers are in that community?
So if you're wondering how theology fits into today's world, or just craving thoughtful, faith-centered conversation, you're in the right place. Conversations on Culture and Faith. Real stories, bold questions, rooted in God's Word. Hallelujah.